Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
I had a dream about Gavin Newsom once, which is really sad.
Hey everyone, from KQED Public Radio, this is Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos.
And I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, if you watch cable news, you've probably seen Congressman Ro Khanna making the rounds. He's become a top spokesman for and defender of Democrats, including President Joe Biden. But he's also unafraid to criticize his own party, including over the war in Gaza.
Khanna is a four-term Democratic congressman who represents Silicon Valley. He returns to Political Breakdown today to talk about Biden's re-election campaign, the conflict between Israel and Hamas, the proposed TikTok ban, and more. But first, we are in studio with our very own Guy Marzorati. Talk about some news of the week. Big sigh of relief for Governor Gavin Newsom overnight when he...
And for me, watching Proposition 1 every afternoon as the results trickled in for more than 2 weeks. Finally, Wednesday night, we got clarity.
The real victim here, Guy Marzorati.
It's all about Guy. You know, I have to say, Berkeley IGS, the last poll before the election, they had it at 50%, 34% no, and 16% undecided. And Mark DiCamillo said, the undecideds break heavily toward no. And that's kind of exactly what happened.
Right. You know, one political consultant I talked to today, Marva Diaz, who runs the great California Target Book, says, you know, in a measure like this, not, you know, we can talk about the more conservative electorate that ended up happening in the primary, but also a measure where there was so much packed into Proposition 1. It was a bonds measure. It was a lot of complex changes to the Mental Health Services Act. And a lot of times when voters are feel like they have to do all this research, it's a lot easier just to say no or maybe, you know, not vote.
Yeah. And I do wonder, I mean, we saw this pass with like bipartisan support in the Senate. I know that, you know, the no side was outspent like, what, 100 million to one or something.
I mean, it was basically all
volunteer. I can't do math. But they spent $11 million on that campaign, which sounds like a lot of money. But in a state like California, which is very expensive to communicate with voters in, it's not that much. And I wonder if part of the problem was not just the messenger, but that it wasn't a bigger coalition of messengers. Like, if you had had Republicans alongside Newsom, would that have made a difference?
Well, and I think, you know, you look, his approval rating has been going down. So people are, you know, not favorably disposed toward him generally. You do have a more conservative electorate that a lot of people just vote, you know, if he's for it, I'm against it. And then, yeah, to your point, Marisa, I think, you know, there were other aspects of this. It was a nuance. Like you said, Guy, it's complicated. And I think people had concerns about maybe mental health funding of other programs, you know, civil liberties issues. And you know,
how much money were already spending on this?
How much money?
Yeah.
When we talked to the governor, I pointed out, like, you know, you're asking for $6.38 billion. You've spent like three times that much.
Right.
And we can't really see a difference.
I mean, on the approval rating, Newsom was actually asked that directly today. He had a celebration press conference. And he was asking, you know, how much do you think your own approval rating really hurt the campaign. He did point to the fact that there was a pretty broad coalition, even in the advertising. We saw ads running up here in Northern California of vets. You know, part of the supportive housing earmark in Prop 1 is for housing for veterans experiencing homelessness. You also saw some sheriffs, Jim Cooper, Luna down in Los Angeles, appear in ads for this. So I felt like there was a broad coalition, but maybe not so much of a precise message. Mm. You know, this was trying to do so much. And I think if you look at the electorate that ended up showing up, maybe a more fiscally conservative electorate, this coming through as a measure that's going to be borrowing money, I think a lot of people felt like this, you know, a spending measure. Maybe that was the electorate that this needed to be tailored toward. But it was difficult because, as you point out, Scott, the opposition was so fractured that there were so many arguments to respond to. You had, you know, civil libertarians, you had mental health service providers. So it was kind of a moving target from a message standpoint.
You know what kind of reminds me of is the bail debate, right? Where you actually had this sort of like weird horseshoe effect where people on the right are just skeptical. They don't agree with the policy, perhaps. And then on the left, you have a sort of schism because people are concerned about these civil liberties concerns. But it is a little, I mean, I still find it kind of remarkable just given how visible the problems are on the streets. And I just don't, like, it's like, what do people want to happen?
Well, I wouldn't also, let's not overstate the pushback on the left. The counties where this did really well are the most liberal counties in California. This cross the finish line when we had a huge batch of votes come in from Alameda County. This, to me, was, when you look at the map of where this was not doing well, this ran into headwinds from fiscal conservatives. And I think if you're going to fault any kind of messaging, maybe there wasn't enough that, hey, this is not a tax, we're not raising new money for this, and maybe even putting forth messages that would have appealed to more conservatives, such as the fact that Prop 1 could fund locked facilities and takes maybe a little bit more of a tough love approach than some of the services in the past.
And not running those in the Bay Area, like run them in San Diego, run them in Fresno, you know, where maybe you might, that might be more appealing. And maybe they did. I don't know. But the other thing is, you know, this, we're hearing all about this week, the deficit that the state has, somewhere between $38 billion and as much as $70 or more. And you have to wonder, you know, is this kind of death? Wasn't death, it survived, but, you know, almost near death by a thousand nicks, you know, were people concerned just about spending money when we have a big deficit?
Yeah, no, certainly that, the deficit news coming in the months where this really needed to capture the attention of voters, I don't think was good for the Prop 1 campaign. All of this said, it did clear the finish line. And I think the dice roll here was, you know, from Newsom's perspective, wanting to get these residential treatment facilities built as quickly as possible, putting it on the March ballot, where, as he said today, he said by October, they're already going to start to be able to be putting the money out. You know, that was the gamble. We'll see.
You do wonder, how long is it going to take to really see the impact of this? Because, you know, if, just construction. Like, if you do that here in the Bay Area, there's all these permits you've got to get and so on and so forth. So,
well, it does have a bit of a golden ticket on the permitting process. They wrote it so that you really can't sort of challenge this in the ways that we've seen folks do in the past. But,
and let's hope it does. Let's hope,
you know,
it makes a difference.
Construction takes a long time. Well, this is a politics show, so let's talk a little bit about the politics here. I mean, Newsom's kind of been in hiding the last few weeks. I mean, it wasn't, it was the Prop 1 stuff. It was also this whole pushback over the fast food law, Panera Gate. We don't even need to get into it because I think that's a bit of an overblown story. But it seemed like between that, this, and the budget deficit, I mean, he delayed his State of the State address. Like, does this, is this a coming out of sorts for the governor today after a few weeks in hiding?
Yeah, no, it definitely, it felt like a collective, like, you know, sigh of relief. But now it's back to, you know, the issues of the budget, right? I mean, I think this is something we're going to see play out over the next few weeks. There was an agreement announced this week around some early action with no details attached on what exactly is being cut. I think we expect this to include a raising of the MCO tax, a way to tax healthcare providers, potentially bringing in more money from the federal government. Going to be some money moving around. But as we get closer to June, the decisions are going to get harder. They're going to take, the way they're approaching this is, let's get the easy
low-hanging fruit
out of the way.
And also paying it forward, because if you cut stuff now, it compounds on itself, right? Like, the earlier you cut, the bigger the cuts are from a dollar amount. But don't you feel like a lot of this and the sort of strangeness over the way that they roll this out in the conversation actually has a lot to do with some tension that's brewing between the Assembly and Senate and the governor's office? I mean, it seems like Mike McGuire, the new Senate leader, is kind of on the same page with Newsom on some of this. And that, you know, Robert Rivas, who was just on our show, is really interested in a sort of more public process.
Yeah, well, we'll see how that process plays out. I mean, in the end, they're going to have to make tough choices, and they can deliberate behind. I mean, look, there really isn't, other than, I suppose, the immediate cuts, maybe like not filling empty positions and saving some money in the short run. But they do have, you know, they have a few months. There's going to be hearings. And so, you know, those of us in the media, we want it to happen right now. But in fact, you know, they do have the time. But I agree with you, Marie. So it does seem like there's a bit of a schism between and they're both new. You know, Rivas and Mike McGuire, both new. So they may be kind of like feeling each other out a little bit.
Yeah. Right? McGuire's only here for a few more years. Rivas is starting what could be a long tenure as the head of the Assembly. And I think he is trying to sort of set some boundaries here and set a sort of tone for the way he thinks this should be done. I mean, I know he said to us, like, they want to do this publicly. They want it to be a process. I think that, you know, it'll be fascinating just to see, like, how the three of them kind of come together or don't in the coming weeks.
And two new budget chairs, right? So this is a moment where I feel like the budget is already a place where the executive largely gets what they want in state government. And you wonder if this is a process in which Newsom can further flex that, given the relative inexperience of the folks handling this for the first time in the legislature.
I guess you'd have to say, like, some of the things, the big things they're talking about are things you've covered, Marisa, like dealing with retail theft. things that don't necessarily cost a lot of money, maybe some. But so I think that's probably, you know, to the good as far as Newsom and the Democrats are concerned. But, you know, they all have their own pet projects, whether it's, you know, health care, expanding health care for people irrespective of their immigration status, education, preschool, you know, and it's been a while. Some of these members have never had to go through a tough budget season, you know, and they're going to get a wake up call.
But I wouldn't overlook this piece. All of the money that's been spent at the federal level by the Biden administration, I think, gives a real security blanket for a lot of these folks in the state legislature to say, let's cut in places where we know money's coming in from the federal government. And I think you're going to see that a lot around these climate programs where it's like, yes, we're cutting, but you might not see any service impacts because of all the spending that's coming from Washington.
Well, all right. So Prop 1's passed. Obviously, we'll keep an eye on how they roll out that bond money, how they oversee what's happening to counties. The budget we'll be watching. Anything else, Guy, we should be keeping an eye on these next couple weeks?
Well, how about that congressional race in the South Bay that at last count is at...
Lowe tripled his lead from one to
three
votes.
I mean, it's incredible. Before the election, I put together a list of like the closest races in Bay Area history. We definitely have a new entry.
And we should say this is Congressional District 16.
Anna Eschew's seat that she's leaving. I know you're going to talk to Congressman Ro Khanna about this, but certainly we're going to be watching this. And, you know, the potential when it's that close, you do get into the range where like maybe a campaign requests a recount and we see where that goes.
And they got to pay for it.
All right. We got to leave it there. KQED politics correspondent Guy Marzorati, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
All right. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk with Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna. You're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio.
Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
Welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Marisa Lagos here with Scott Schaefer. Today our guest is Silicon Valley Congressman Ro Khanna. Congressman Khanna, welcome back to The Breakdown.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're happy to have you. As we mentioned at the top, you have been acting as a surrogate for the Biden campaign, and we want to jump in to that race. Polls show a tight contest between Biden and Trump. And, you know, among the groups the president is struggling to excite are young voters, Latinos, Black voters. I'm just curious, like, how do you see, what is the sort of secret sauce here that Democrats need to be doing to bring those voters back into the fold, excite them again?
The president did a great job in the State of the Union, and you see the polls closing since his speech, and he laid out the choice. He laid out an affirmative vision for his agenda, that he was going to help people with housing, help people get into first-time homes. He was going to help on child care. He's going to help on raising wages. And that Donald Trump is just going to be providing tax breaks for the very wealthy. We need to drive home that choice and really build on what he did in the State of the Union.
It sounds like you're not that concerned. Are you?
Well, I'm of course concerned. It's a close race. Anyone looking at the polls would be concerned. But I am confident that if we do what we need to do, then we will win the race, that our coalition is bigger than Donald Trump's coalition. The important thing is to mobilize everyone.
Let's talk a little bit more about Gaza. I know that you have been to Michigan. You've talked to Arab American voters and others. Where do you see things? I mean, we saw Chuck Schumer really talk very clearly about his differences with Prime Minister Netanyahu. What is it going to take from that the U.S. has control over to make a difference to these voters?
I think we start with acknowledging that the October 7th attack was a brutal terrorist attack with rapes and sexual violence, and unequivocally condemn it. And Israel had a right to get the Hamas perpetrators. But the way Netanyahu has gone about this, in defiance of the President of the United States, in defiance of the Defense Secretary, he's talking about invading Rafah today with his advisors, when our president has said very clearly not to do that. It means that we need to make sure that we're supporting Israel, but not the extreme right-wing government. And that means a few key policy changes. First, We shouldn't be banning UNRWA funding for a year. I'll be voting no on the bill that bans that UNRWA funding. That UNRWA funding is needed to prevent Palestinian kids from starving. And second, we need to make it clear to Netanyahu we aren't going to continue to transfer weapons to him if he's going to defy the President of the United States. And third, we need a permanent ceasefire with the release of all hostages.
Well, sticking with what's happening in Israel and Gaza, I mean, I know you didn't call for an immediate ceasefire after the October 7th attacks. You clearly just laid out how horrific those were and your support for Israel. But also you have said since then that there should be. And I know recently you also criticized the president for his, quote, bear hug of Netanyahu. Can you talk a little bit more about that and like what conditions you think the U.S. should place on weapons, where you think we should be taking this conversation?
It should be pretty simple. If you defy what the President of the United States is saying and go into Rafah, we shouldn't be transferring weapons. If you're defying what our Secretary of State is saying and not opening landlines to get food in, then we shouldn't be transferring offensive weapons. The United States stood in solidarity with Israel after October 7th. I did. Many people did. But the way Netanyahu has gone about this with his extreme right-wing government has been callous in terms of their respect for the United States as an ally and in terms of their respect for human life. And that has to have some policy consequence. And I think the president can say that I support and have always supported the U.S.-Israel relationship, but I want to be a peacemaker. That means a two-state solution. That means a permanent ceasefire and release of hostages. That means a new Palestinian state, recognizing it, which doesn't have Hamas.
Do you think that's even possible with Netanyahu and the coalition that he has in power?
Well, I think that Netanyahu has not been a good leader, and Senator Schumer said that, and he was criticizing what Netanyahu has done. He's undermining the two-state solution. He has undermined support, at least among young people in the United States. And that's why I think Senator Schumer spoke out.
Do you feel, I mean, obviously Schumer coming out and saying that was huge, but it seems like there is sort of seemingly at least unconditional support for Israel among in Democratic politics. We interviewed Representative Adam Schiff recently, and he wouldn't even say that the response has been disproportionate. I just wonder if you feel like you're still in the minority with mainstream Democrats, if the tide seems to be shifting. If you think someone like the president, who's been such a staunch supporter, would actually, you know, kind of take this to the next step that you're pushing.
Well, I think one can be a supporter of the U.S.-Israel relationship, as I have been. I've been to Israel twice. I met with the prime ministers. I've been there with Speaker Pelosi. I've talked about the technology cooperation between the United States and Israel, and still recognize that we can't have a famine of young children dying in Palestine, and that Netanyahu is being cruel by not allowing aid trucks in on the Gaza northern border. That it doesn't make sense to defund UNRWA, which is providing aid to Palestinians, when the head of UNRWA, Lazzarini, is screaming to the world saying we need this aid in, and when Canada and Australia and a lot of European countries are now funding them. So I believe that the way to have a U.S.-Israel relationship is one on a progressive direction with the end of the occupation in Gaza and the West Bank and a two-state solution.
We've seen Netanyahu in the past play footsie with Trump. He came and spoke in 2012 to Congress at the invitation of Republicans when Obama was running against Mitt Romney. And now we're seeing Trump trying to cozy up to Netanyahu. There's talk the GOP in the House may invite him to come speak to Congress. Would it be appropriate for him to come now and speak to Congress over the objections of the Biden administration?
No, it would not, and he would further politicize the U.S.-Israel relationship, which is a shame. Look, the president has staked so much political capital in supporting Israel, and it really is sad that Netanyahu continues to defy him. I mean, when the president has said, let in aid across the Gaza border, Netanyahu has said no. When the president said, don't go into Rafah, Just today, the president's, the Netanyahu's advisor is saying, we don't care what the United States says. We're going to do whatever we want. And that is not how allies treat each other. And so if Netanyahu now is going to go around the president of the United States to score political points in the United States, he's really hurting the long-term relationship.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Political Breakdown from KQED Public Radio. I'm Marisa Lagos, here with Scott Schaefer. Our guest today, Congressman Ro Khanna. Going back to the kind of broader politics here, I want to ask you about border security. It is shaping up to be a huge issue this election year, and it seems like a fight that the GOP really wants. You know, Trump helped kill a bill in Congress, a bipartisan deal on the border. We're seeing a face-off in court over a Texas law to let local police enforce immigration laws. What do you think the Biden administration should be doing to ensure doesn't lose this fight politically, especially if there's not a path in Congress?
Well, the Biden administration just needs to tell the truth, which is that the president has been trying for 3 years to solve this issue. He has proposed bill after bill to get more Border Patrol agents funded, to have secure borders, to have a humane process of coming in, to have people processed outside the United States to the extent they can before coming here, to have families kept in place when they come, to keep people who have legitimate asylum claims to have the right to do that, but not folks who don't have legitimate claims. And he got Republicans on board with a bill that was quite conservative, more conservative than I like. I criticized elements of it. And the only reason we don't have that is because Donald Trump said that Republicans voting for this would give Joe Biden a political win, and he sabotaged it. And I think when we tell people the truth that the president wants to fix the problem, Donald Trump wants to campaign on the problem, the American people will side with the president.
I want to ask you about TikTok. You were one of 50 Democrats, mostly progressives, who voted against the House bill to essentially ban TikTok as it currently exists. What was your reasoning on that?
Well, Scott, it wasn't just for progressives. It was also Jim Himes, who was the ranking member on intelligence, and Greg Meeks, the ranking member on foreign affairs. The people who actually know the most on foreign affairs in our Congress. And that is because the bill was not solving the problem. The bill it would not solve the problem of data brokers giving data to China. If you want to solve the problem, have a bill that bans any data going to a foreign country. Have a bill that bans any foreign government for interfering in algorithms on social media. Require algorithmic transparency. But instead, it's sort of a soundbite. Let's ban TikTok without dealing with the actual meat of the issue.
Do you see, I mean, it seems like very unlikely that if this bill were to pass and get signed, that there would actually be a path for this company to get sold. The Chinese government has said they don't want to see that. I mean, and what is it, 170 million users? I mean, so many people use this. It's so interesting. Like, when people are talking about the politics of this on the Hill, are they worried about the potential backlash from constituents?
Well, there's a First Amendment issue for all of these users, and there are ways to safeguard their data so the Chinese Communist Party doesn't get it without banning it. But the reason I think that the Hill isn't more concerned is because the Hill is so out of touch with technology. I mean, 50% of the Congress probably, you know, wouldn't be able to get create an account on TikTok, let alone use TikTok. So, you know, you have a group of folks making laws about social media when most of them have never even used social media. They've got some 20 or 30 year old staff person who does it for them.
Hmm. You said that a more narrowly tailored law, maybe one focused on protecting privacy, would be better. But even there, I mean, what's to stop data brokers from just selling data that they have to China?
Well, we need to not only protect data privacy, we need to make it illegal for any U.S. company or any U.S. subsidiary to transfer data to a foreign government or to foreign nationals in places that the United States considers a risk. And then, okay, you say, well, what if data brokers are doing it? Well, they could face prosecution or civil fines. What if TikTok's doing it? Well, then Oracle could face fines as their data management in Texas. And the three board members were Americans could face fines, and the American investors could face fines or liability. But instead of actually trying to have a law that solves the problem and then prosecuting it, we just went to a TikTok ban. Now, if we tried the other approach and it didn't work and there was still a problem, maybe eventually we could say, okay, the only thing that possibly works is a ban, but we're so far from that.
I'm curious. I mean, you represent Silicon Valley. There's been a lot of speculation that a TikTok ban would actually help companies like Meta or X or, you know, other social media companies that are based here. What are they telling you? Have you been lobbied by other companies around this issue?
You know, I have not, but I've represented the Valley for 8 years, and they know I'm pretty independent. and so I don't think they would take the effort to do that. And, you know, and I think that this is not something that they're fighting for. I mean, there are other issues that they definitely care about, and where I voted on Internet Bill of Rights or antitrust, where I hear their perspective. But on this issue, I honestly have not heard from any of the other tech companies, even though many of them, some of them may stand to benefit from a TikTok ban.
I want to ask you about AI, artificial intelligence. You've written about the promise and the problems of AI, and you wrote, "We have to center the dignity and economic security of working class Americans when we think about this." What do you mean by that?
Well, AI is going to allow for extraordinary production and an extraordinary wealth generation, and it's going to increase productivity of companies. The question is, who's going to benefit from that new wealth, from that new industry? Is it just going to be the shareholders and the executive team, or is it also going to be the workers? And my view is that the workers need to also benefit from the increased productivity of companies, and the workers need to be involved in making sure that AI is used as a tool for augmenting people's skills, not simply eliminating them, and that if jobs are changing, the workers are being given the credentialing to have some of those new responsibilities.
I want to switch gears a little bit and ask you about a neighboring congressional district. This is Anna Eshoo's seat. She is retiring. And this has been a real nail biter of a race. The first place spot was taken by former San Jose Mayor Sam Liccardo, but Evan Lowe, assemblyman who you endorsed, and Joe Simidian, longtime politician in the area, are locked neck and neck. I think they're separated by 3 votes, according to the latest count. Have you talked to Lowe? How's he feeling? How are you feeling? It must be crazy to watch this.
Well, first of all, let me say, I wish every congressional district in America had the type of candidates we had in that district. I mean, not only did you have Evan Lowe and Sam Liccardo and Joe Smitty, and you had the dean of Stanford running. You had an extraordinary vet who has built successful businesses running. It was a plethora of great candidates. And I'm proud to have endorsed Evan. I was joking with him. I spoke to him a day or two ago. I said, "This is doing wonders for your name ID. Now everyone knows who you are because everyone's following the race." But it's going back and forth, and I'm hopeful he'll come out in the second place at the end of the count, but it's going to be very close between him and Joe Smidian.
All right. That is Silicon Valley Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna speaking to us from D.C., where I think he has to rush back to another vote. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Always enjoy it.
And that's a wrap for Thursday, March 21st. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED Public Radio.
Our producer is Izzy Bloom. I'm Scott Schaefer.
And I'm Marisa Lagos. We'll see you next time.